sound amazing. That's a big sale, and I'm going to tell you exactly how I did it. But the truth is, the sale had really started over 5 years before. And the card I had up my sleeve was follow-up. Classic, well-executed follow-up. F1, the follow-up. Becoming a master of follow-up is one of the most important things a salesperson can do to increase sales. Great follow-up comes in three stages. But let's talk about the first one, which is like a golfer swinging at the ball. It's the first step toward making a sale, and you can't get very far without it. The golf ball isn't gonna move itself. I don't mean calling your leads incessantly and annoying everyone to the point where they dread seeing your name on their phone or in their inbox. Good follow-up, just like a good golf game, is an art form. It takes practice, grace, and diligence to make the ball go where you want, and eventually in the hole. And it works. Had I not been on my follow-up A-game, the international man of mystery still would have bought an incredibly expensive apartment. It just wouldn't have been for me. Another broker would have gotten that commission. Ouch. And that would have really sucked because he and I go way back. It all started on Thursday, March 8th, 2012. I was excited about going to work every day, but this day was special. I couldn't wait to get to the office. I hadn't been this excited since my dad surprised me and my brother with PlayStation 1 on a random Tuesday after 18 months of relentless begging. The first episode of the first season of Million Dollar Listing New York had aired the night before, and this was obviously going to change the entire course of my career overnight. In anticipation of the awesomeness coming my way, I moved my desk out from a dark corner and next to a bright, sunny window. I was like a seventh grader who had abandoned his trapper keeper so he could hang out with the cool kids. I felt like a baller. I expected to walk into the office and find a flurry of activity. The phones would be ringing like crazy, and my assistant Yolanda would be like, "Ryan, thank God you're here. The entire city has called. Everyone wants you to be their broker." Instead, I walked into a completely silent office. I sat down at my desk and turned on my computer. Nope, no new emails of importance. A few people reached out to say that they saw some show on Bravo with a guy who looked like me, and I should check it out. Great. The whole day passed painfully slowly. Million Dollar Listing was supposed to make the phone ring off the hook, and all I got was a fourth grade friend on Facebook telling me I looked like some guy on TV. At 5 p.m., it was time to go to Equinox for my afternoon workout and Soho client search, and then it happened. The phone rang. It was Miss Vivian A. Locke of Scarsdale, New York. "I saw you on a real estate show last night," she said. "I think it was on HGTV. Anyway, I liked you. You're funny. My husband Sebastian and I were thinking of buying an apartment in the city and would love for you to show us some places. Our budget is about $3 million. Yes, this was it. A $3 million buyer just cold called my office? Amazing. At that point in my career, I'd only done a handful of deals over $3 million. I made plans to meet with the Locks the next day. The next morning, I was standing in front of Starbucks, nervously looking through the crowds on the sidewalk to see if I could pinpoint who my clients were, when a gigantic and very shiny Range Rover pulled up. The back door opened up, and out stepped an attractive 40-something woman and a tan man with dark hair and a gray beard. He was wearing the nicest suit I'd ever seen, and sunglasses and watch to match. Since I didn't have my own car or driver, I asked them if they wanted to get into a taxi or take the train. They laughed and said to hop into the front seat. Their driver would take us. I didn't grow up under a rock, but I'd never been in a car like that. Nor had I ever met someone's personal driver. The car smelled like gold, awesomeness, and leather. My life had just changed. I had entered a new dimension of real estate brokerage, and it smelled good. That day, I showed them several apartments on the Upper East Side. We talked in the car in between showings about what they wanted in their New York home away from home. They were incredibly nice people, but they didn't really agree on what they liked. He wanted huge windows, lots of light, close to Midtown. She wanted cozy, gorgeous finishes right on Central Park. They really liked a beautiful two-bedroom next to the Frick Collection on East 70th Street, but they weren't ready to pull the trigger. They dropped me off at my office, and I went back into the Starbucks and got a chai latte to drown my sorrows. During the next few weeks, I kept following up with updates on different listings. When working with buyers, it's important to keep momentum. Once a buyer cools on spending this kind of money, it's very tough to get them motivated again. Mrs. Locke then decided they were open to looking in different areas. The Upper West Side, Soho, the West Village, Tribeca, Chelsea, and then the Financial District. And, oh, did we check out Gramercy? And wait, how about Brooklyn? We haven't seen every inch of that borough yet. Over the next 6 months, I showed Mrs. Locke apartments in small buildings and high-rises. I showed her lofts and townhouses, anything she wanted to see. Sometimes her husband would accompany us, but most of the time he was too busy and it was just Viv and me touring the entirety of the five boroughs for hours at a time. I no longer work like this, by the way. I learned my lesson after working with buyer after buyer who wouldn't actually buy anything. Now I qualify buyers, I help them focus, and teach them that purchasing property is a process of elimination, not a shopping spree. I never let the Locks go, though. I showed them apartments all over the city for a year. Every time they got close to making an offer, Sebastian would find something objectionable. Like there weren't enough windows, the lobby was weird, or the closets were too small for his sexy suit collection. I was beginning to suspect that, for whatever reason, these two were not going to be buying an apartment in New York City in the near future. Maybe they just liked real estate, or liked watching TV shows about real estate. Oh no, I was their celebrity real estate tour guide. My business had really started to grow during that time, and I had plenty of other balls in the air. I had signed up a new development on Gramercy Park, and I was starting a team, but I did not forget about Mr. and Mrs. Locke. I decided I would follow up every 3 weeks, religiously, until they bought an apartment or I was dead, tragically young. Or I read that they'd perished in a fiery car chase in Monte Carlo. I was going to implement the first F, follow-up, by sending them emails about new developments, listings I thought they would like, and highlights from the Sirhan Team newsletter. A successful salesperson is a conscientious follow-upper. Just because you're ready for your client to buy something doesn't mean they are. But when they are, you want to be right there and ready for them. So make sure you're doing the appropriate amount of follow-up by breaking down your leads into three categories. Hot. Hot clients are ready to buy something now. They have a timeline set, you're in touch with them every day, you're keeping them posted on any product development or sales, you're making it clear you're working hard for them. Warm. Warm clients are thinking about buying something. They are buy curious. You're in touch with them once a week, also keeping them posted on developments and sales. Cold. Cold clients are not actively looking to buy, but that doesn't mean you don't follow up. You're still in touch with cold clients once or twice a month. When they do decide to buy something, there you are, like magic. The follow-up party with the International Man of Mystery continued. It had been months, and now he just wasn't responding, and neither was my travel buddy, Viv. I had follow-up time blocked out of my calendar every week for warm and cold clients. I spoke to hot prospects every day. Following up is not really a fun task, so put it in your calendar so you're forced to do it. Why would I devote an hour of follow-up when I could be watching Grey's Anatomy? Because my calendar said so. That's why. Eventually, this will become automatic, like muscle memory, and you won't have to put follow-up on your calendar anymore. But until following up becomes as natural to you as brushing your teeth in the morning, follow-up has got to go on the calendar. International Man of Mystery continued to hear from me every few weeks, even though he did not answer any of my emails. But then suddenly, from Ryan Sirhant, sent Thursday, December 12th, 2013, 1:30 p.m. to Sebastian, subject 33 East 74th. Dear Sebastian, have you heard of the new development at 33 East 74th? It is six row houses that used to belong to the Whitney Museum, now being converted to condos. 10 units between 4,000 square foot three bedrooms up to 10,000 square foot five bedrooms, starting at $13 million. Expected to be completed by 2015. Hope you're well. Could work well for you. Ryan Serhant. From Sebastian. Sent Friday, December 13th, 2013, 10:56 a.m. to Ryan Serhant. Subject, 33 East 74th. Ryan, thanks. I had not heard about this. Something to consider. I hope all is well and best wishes for a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He answered! I was almost giddy, like I just won the lottery. However, the International Man of Mystery did not buy any of those gorgeous apartments at 33 East 74th Street. The big $17 million deal was still 4 years away and over 100 follow-ups later. If you think I knew he was eventually going to buy, you're wrong. If you're wondering if I ever thought of just giving up, I didn't. Here's the thing. Most people would have given up. They would have tossed him to the side like socks at Christmas. Why put in effort if he isn't gonna buy an apartment right now? But following up is so easy. When you incorporate follow-up into your regular sales practice, jotting off a quick and friendly email is practically effortless. And it's free. It's free! It costs you nothing to send an email. And it takes less time than it does to make yourself a donut shop flavored Keurig coffee. If there was any chance the Locks were going to buy an apartment, ever, it was going to be from me. Let the follow-up parade continue. When you follow up with the lead, don't just send a generic email or a note saying, "Hey, do you still want to buy a hot tub? Because I have one I can sell you." Who wants to get that email? Always follow up with value in your message. Include information about a sale or a new product. You just came across an article that says people who have hot tubs are so relaxed that they outlive poor slobs who do not have hot tubs. Include that along with a friendly message about how you're offering free delivery this week only. I follow all of my clients on social media. I also save all of their birthdays in my calendar. The other day, I noticed that Greta Lambert's son, James, had just celebrated his 10th birthday. It was an opportunity for an easy, friendly follow-up message. I shot her an email. "Wow, James is growing up so quickly. Your apartment must be feeling small." Greta responded, "Ryan, good to hear from you. It does feel small." Now, she's a warm lead, and I'll follow up next week with some listings in her area. The friendly follow-up has a stronger impact. Finally, on a Sunday in early December of 2016, I got a call from the International Man of Mystery himself. I hadn't heard from him since that one brief email around Christmas 3 years earlier. During this call, I learned a few important things. He was now divorced. Not surprised. His financial picture had changed. His budget for an apartment had increased from $3 million to between $15 and $20 million. Oh my God. He called me because I had been so diligent about keeping in touch for so long. Follow-up really works. And it absolutely is worth the small amount of time and effort it takes. We made a date to start looking at apartments. And this time, without Mrs. Locke, he was able to make a decision very quickly. He closed April 7th, 2017. My commission check was $510,000, or about $280 per day since I first met him. F2, the follow-through. The Harmony House at 61 West 62nd Street is an Upper West Side high-rise close to Lincoln Center and Central Park. While the name of the building conjures up images of sunshine and rainbows, something quite different was waiting behind the door of apartment 21E. The owners were into the Gothic revival look, and the entire apartment was outfitted to look like a Spanish Catholic church. You know, normal. There were frescoes and prayer candles everywhere, and as I walked through the apartment, I may have imagined hearing organ music. In the living room, right next to the brown velvet sectional sofa, was an actual confessional booth from the 19th century. The confessional booth was convenient, since it soon became clear this apartment was really meant for sinners. The first time I was in the apartment, I noticed a hook hanging from the ceiling in the middle of the living room. And guess what? It wasn't for plants. It was for a sex swing. There was also a surveillance system, and you could watch what was going on in every room of the apartment from every room of the apartment. Because goth chic does not say home sweet home to most people, this apartment was an incredibly tough sell. Eventually, with the help of underwear models, I was able to perform a miracle and sell the Church of Kinky at full asking price about 6 months after listing it. During the time it was on the market, I met a lot of buyers. One, Mr. Campbell Killian, had come to an open house hoping to find more space for his growing family. Instead, he found a makeshift church, and that wasn't what he was looking for, apparently. Since Campbell appeared to be a normal person, I completely understood why this apartment wasn't a match for him. I added him to my database and proceeded to give him the full Sirhant follow-up treatment. Eventually, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to sell Campbell's duplex penthouse on the Upper West Side. There were many pros to this apartment. It was 2,750 square feet and had three terraces and 600 square feet of outdoor space, high ceilings, four bedrooms, and five bathrooms. This place was ideal for a family. But where there are pros, there are also cons. This place had a big con. Two penthouses had been combined, stitched together awkwardly into a Frankenstein-esque creation. The rooms just didn't fit together right. There were two living rooms, one on each side of the kitchen, and the apartment had more stairways than an Escher drawing. It was a tough sell. Immediately upon walking into the apartment, every single person said, "Weird layout," and exited the apartment via one of the countless miniature sets of stairs. A big pro was that the apartment was kid-friendly with lots of play space, and I ended up having a party for moms and kids. This was the only time I got my face painted, wore clown-sized sunglasses, and danced with toddlers to make a sale. And it worked! Enter the second F, follow through. If follow up is hitting the ball, follow through sets the direction of where that ball is going to go. I'm terrible at golf, and baseball, and all other sports with balls, but I still know that if you don't follow through when you swing, the ball is probably going to fall flat or go sideways. While I was happy to have found a buyer for Campbell's penthouse, I also learned that real estate was a bit of a hobby for him. He enjoyed following trends, researching new developments, and generally staying up to date on the market. He is often in touch with me with questions about listings he sees. One time, he wanted me to research a house he was curious about, in Iowa. Some realtors might find this annoying, or view it as something they don't have time to do. Anytime someone on my team tells me they're too busy to answer clients, the next day they're not on my team. Customer service and follow-through are paramount to referral business from clients just like Campbell. So even though I had no idea what houses in Iowa were worth, I was happy to get more information for him. It's worth it to me, because anytime Campbell thinks about real estate, I want him to automatically think two things. One, Ryan is who I turn to for all things real estate. And two, when I ask Ryan to do something, if he says he will, it's done every time. Sirhant's secret number 11. Always treat clients like they are brand new. Your database of customers isn't a mailing list. It's a list of relationships. If you want to have repeat customers and sell more, you must take care of these relationships, even at times when there isn't immediate money to be made. I tell my team to think of each and every person they work with as a brand new client, even if they've been clients for years. Always remember that your clients are your social currency. If someone gave you a $100 bill 10 years ago, it's still worth $100 today. An old client is as valuable as a new client. And to those of you who are whipping out your calculators and are about to email me that due to inflation, the $100 bill isn't really worth $100 today, let me save you the time by assuring you that I'm familiar with the concept of inflation. I'm just trying to make a point. Anyone can follow up by pushing calls and emails, but follow through is the next level. It's simple. Do what you say you're going to do. If you tell a client you'll do some research and get back to them, do it. If you say you will answer your emails within 12 hours, do it. If you make a promise to yourself that you're going to meet 3 new people every day, don't sell yourself short. Do it. Following through is a huge opportunity to show clients you're invested, that you care about them, and that you're dependable. When you want to sell more and build relationships with repeat clients, follow through is the simple tactic that can set you apart from everyone else. Want proof? After lots of follow through, Campbell bought a $36 million apartment on Park Avenue with me. Be accountable to yourself and others with follow through. If you told yourself you're going to devote a certain amount of time to finding new leads and you're having trouble keeping that promise, create accountability. Make a plan with a team member or create a competition to push you to do it. F3, the follow back. It was December 2016 in New York. That meant I would spend nearly every evening until the end of the year awkwardly socializing at holiday parties around town. I was at the annual Madison Realty Party at the Boom Boom Room above the Standard Hotel. It's a great networking event. I was standing around with a group of people when I met a banker named Jonathan Stern. I introduced myself, quickly moving my teriyaki chicken skewer into my other hand before reaching for a handshake. Stern was developing some properties in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, an area I had really come to appreciate. We talked about how quickly Greenpoint was becoming Brooklyn's hottest neighborhood, and how we loved the area's unusual combination of Polish restaurants and art galleries. We exchanged contact information, and I went to get a drink and explore the mini hamburger selection before heading home to my favorite human in the world, Emilia. In the elevator ride down to the street, I sent Stern an email telling him I enjoyed meeting him 5 minutes ago, and I'd love to set up a meeting to see his projects. I asked if Tuesday or Wednesday would be better. Never wait to follow up. Follow up now. It's one of my little tricks to get attention. No one follows up faster than I do. And when you want to set up that follow-up meeting, propose dates that work for you. Don't just ask if they're free. Take control of the destiny of your working relationship. Stern responded that he and his brother-in-law had a development going up on McCarran Park on the Greenpoint side of Brooklyn. Yes! But there was one catch. I already have a broker working on it, he said. But would you like to take a tour of the building? Yes, I would. The building tour took place on a day that I would describe as snowing, sleeting, insane, hellfire winter. It was just a few weeks after our run-in at the Boom Boom Room, so I bundled up like I was Jon Snow and made my way carefully to Greenpoint. After the tour, I thanked everyone and told them I'd do whatever I could to bring them as many buyers as possible. I added Stern's brother-in-law Chad Gessen to my contact list and made sure they received the Sirhan Team monthly newsletter. I did not try to poach the client, because that's gross, and that's happened to me, and I hate it. I started following back. I would keep in touch, making a point of showing them how diligent I am and how dedicated I would be on their next project. I wasn't the broker on this project, but I wanted to be in the forefront of Chad's mind if he had a new development going up. This was my opportunity to possibly get the ball back in play. Fast forward 6 months. It's June. And I get a call from Chad out of the blue on a Monday. He says they're about to launch 868 Lorimer, the building we toured back in January, but he needs a new broker. He said I was relentless with my outreach, and that's the kind of broker he needs selling his apartments. Are you interested? Of course. Then he asked if I could launch the project by Thursday. sure? I had no idea how I was going to get everything ready in time. For a new development of this size, I am typically involved for at least 6 months, and most times a year or two before launching sales. This time, I had 4 days! 4 days to get all the visuals, digital and printed marketing collateral, floor plans, written descriptions, ads written and developed, launch party designed and planned, invites created, and the list goes on. We needed a marketing plan, a pitch, and a sales team all ready to go in less than a week. It was crazy. My hair definitely went grayer, but we did it, and it was amazing. We sold 90% of the units in the building in 6 months and broke 2 price records while doing it, all because I sent an email to his relative in an elevator after a holiday party and then followed back with them for months. Following back is different from just following up with a client you're already working with. Following back is keeping in touch with past clients or people who did not hire you, and it is one of the biggest opportunities that salespeople miss out on. Following up is touching base that first time. It's hitting the ball. Following through is making sure the ball goes where you want it to go. And following back is getting right back to the ball so you can hit it again. That's how golf works, and that's how sales work. And if you follow the three Fs, as I've shown you, you will get that ball in the hole. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten a new client because that person never heard from their broker again after a closing. Ever again. Why? The idea of someone not following back with a customer makes me want to throw up. It's easy and a sincere way to build a relationship with a repeat customer. It's also a way to keep a door open for an opportunity that isn't yours to be had at that moment. I don't get every job I pitch, very much to my dismay, but I don't see that as the end of the opportunity. I can still show a developer or client how awesome I really am and why they should hire me next time by following back. The closing of the deal is just the beginning of the relationship. It is a huge mistake to assume the relationship with a customer ends when they buy your product. The closing of the deal represents the beginning of a new chapter in the relationship. Follow back after the sale. Ask how they're enjoying that hot tub, if the kitchen renovation is going well, or even if the dress they bought for their daughter's wedding was a hit. Follow back leads to repeat customers. Another big developer in New York had a new condominium project I desperately wanted to sell in Park Slope. I pitched my heart out for this project, but the developer didn't go with me. He thought I was too small at the time. I could have just been annoyed or angry. Too small? Really? Or I could follow back to show that this perceived flaw was ultimately something that didn't matter at all. I decided to send the developer a gift as a thank you for letting me pitch him. I ordered a 10-foot fig tree that took 4 people to deliver and had it sent to his office with a note that simply read, "Impact." My new development team may have been small at the time, but make no mistake, I know how to make an impact. He noticed. 2 years later, after many follow-ups, he called me and said he had a new project that will be Brooklyn's first super tall skyscraper. He wanted me to pitch him. I nailed it. At least, I thought I did. That is, until he said I would hear back from him in a couple of months. What? I could be dead by then. Except, I won't. I'll be alive because I really want to sell this building. I could let that drive me bananas and sit around by the phone like a 16-year-old waiting for a girl to call, or I could use this as an opportunity to follow back. My team and I worked together to figure out how we could make another impact, something bigger and more meaningful than a tree. We bought a very attractive, modern, and architecturally interesting bookcase and had it delivered to his office. But we didn't stop there. The next day, we sent a book with a note. We did the same thing the next day, and the next day, every single day. By the time he decides which broker to use, he will have a well-curated collection of books sitting on his beautiful bookshelf. I knew I was the right broker for the project, and I was determined to send him a book a day until he chose me. Did it guarantee it would get me the job? No, it did not. But it would be impossible for him to not think of my team, our passion, our determination, and our generosity every time he walked into his office. And that is a big impact. A month later, he sent me an email. The subject was Brooklyn. The body said, "You win. Let's do it. Books can stop now." As salespeople, we can't get every single client. Hearing, "No, I've gone with someone else," is just part of the business. It can suck. I hate it so much. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the end of the story. Deals can die. But relationships never can. Using the three Fs gives you some control. Following up, following through, and following back provide an extra, free, and easy opportunity to show clients what you're really made of, like awesomeness, etc. The next time you don't get a client you want, just remember this isn't necessarily the end of the chapter. Get out your calendar, block out some time for follow-up, and see where the three Fs can take you. And if all else fails, there's always the fourth F. Fuck it. The Sir Hant way. The three F's rule is one of my most valuable sales secrets, and I don't understand why everyone isn't doing it all the time. Block out time in your calendar for follow-up, and watch how new business practically lands in your lap. The follow-up. 1. Never expect people to get in touch with you. 2. Follow up until you get a yes or you read their obituary. 3. Follow up with active clients every single day. 4. Follow up is smacking the ball. It's the first step. The follow through. 5. Do what you say you're going to do. 6. Create accountability if you need to. 7. Never forget you don't just have clients. You have relationships. 8. Follow through drives the ball where you want it to go. The follow back. 9. Keep in touch with past clients. 10. The relationship does not end at the closing. 11. Touch base with clients you lost. 12. Follow back is your opportunity to get the ball back into play. Chapter 5. The 7 Stages of Selling. Every salesperson knows this client, no matter what industry you're in. Sarah didn't want an apartment, she wanted a unicorn. The apartment she wanted just didn't exist, and nothing made her happy. I showed her 2 bedrooms on the Upper West Side, too small. 3 bedrooms in Long Island City, too big. I showed her apartments on low floors, too low. And then on high floors, Ryan, I can't live here, I have vertigo. But I was determined to find something she liked. It nearly killed me. During what was becoming a very long and drawn-out process, I made sure to pay attention to everything she liked and didn't like. She said yes to new construction, outdoor spaces, and open kitchens, and no to older buildings, low ceilings, and apartments with cats. The cat goes, but the kitty litter smell remains. She really liked an apartment on 23rd Street. Unfortunately, during the showing, we could hear the residents on the other side of the living room wall having sex. And whoever lived on the other side of the master bedroom was an avid video game player. A listing on the Upper East Side had a great terrace. But as we took in the view and she was about to make an offer, the guy next door climbed over his terrace right onto the one we were standing on to say hello. True story. Eventually, I found a new listing that ticked off every single box. No cats, sexy video gamers, or terrace hoppers. It had the right number of bedrooms, there was an outdoor space with a view, it was the penthouse but it wasn't too high up, and it had an open kitchen. We walked in, and instead of thanking me for being the best broker in the world because I had found her a unicorn with magic glitter rainbow wings, she took a quick look and said, "No, I don't feel it." She didn't feel it? I started to think I wasn't going to find Sarah an apartment, at least not before I hit retirement age. I hated the idea of giving up, but I couldn't find her anything she liked. The following week, I asked Sarah to meet me for a drink at a bar in Midtown because I had to cut ties with her or start taking blood pressure medication. When I got to the bar, we ordered our drinks, and I was getting ready to initiate a really awkward conversation when she suddenly said, "Hey, did you know there's a really good strip club right across the street? Let's go." It turns out that Sarah loves strip clubs. Really loves them. Sarah had a very successful career in the fitness industry. She was a workout fanatic and could probably do more push-ups than I could. Apparently, she appreciated an opportunity to check out other women's bodies. So, off to the strip club we went. Sarah was entranced by the display of washboard abs and well-cut biceps. To be clear, this wasn't a freaky sex thing. Sarah was like a professor doing research, curious and appreciative of the level of core strength it would take to perform an aerial invert on a pole. I never had the chance to break up with her because we were too busy pondering how many grams of lean protein these women ate daily. I learned something about Sarah that night. I realized that watching these young women was like a release. Perhaps it was even an escape from her own insecurities. She was older now, a mom, and recently divorced. Even though she was fit, Sarah told me she lamented the fact that she no longer had the body of a 21-year-old stripper. It's like the strip club empowered her and gave her an extra boost of motivation. We left at midnight, and Sarah went home to work out. I still planned to give Sarah some space, but the next day, I noticed a listing in Chelsea that seemed too good to be true. The price was low because the building was surrounded by new construction and they were having trouble selling. It had a good view, an outdoor space, and a great gym, but the kicker? It was next to a strip club. I knew if this didn't work, that nothing would, and I would have exhausted every possible option. It would be time to retire this ball. I gave Sarah an address and asked her to meet me there. I told her I had something to show her, and she should prepare to be wowed. She had a big smile on her face when I arrived. "Ryan, I thought you were showing me an apartment. If you wanted to hang out at Scores, why didn't you just say so?" She looked a little confused when I led her through a doorway right next to the strip club. We got into the elevator and went up to the penthouse on the 12th floor, not high enough to give her vertigo. It was a beautiful apartment, big rooms with a bright, open kitchen. Even better, it had a private rooftop cabana with an outdoor kitchen. While the interior space wasn't as big as she would have liked, she was happy with all the positives, including the proximity to Scores. She made an offer that day. She had found her perfect home. Sirhan's secret number 12. Checking boxes is for to-do lists, not for getting deals done. When Sarah said no to the initial apartment with the view that I thought was perfect for her, I wanted to jump right off the balcony I had worked so hard to find. It ticked off the boxes, but she didn't feel it. Checking boxes doesn't get deals done. Good salespeople know what to expect from clients during every phase of the deal because they are in tune with their clients' emotions as they pass through each phase. Sarah was nervous about her apartment search and kept hoping there would be something better. This wasn't just a decision about an apartment. It was about her future. I realized these were the same feelings she tapped into at the strip club. I wasn't struggling to find Sarah an apartment because she was difficult, but because she was disappointed. She had hit that stage in the sale. When I was able to empathize with what she was feeling, I was able to guide her to the right place and get a deal. When we found her a perfect home, one that made Sarah feel comfortable to make such a big purchase, she was able to commit. There's often an underlying element that moves a person into a comfort zone of buying. I had a client who insisted on living downtown, wouldn't venture above 23rd Street for anything except the opera. When an apartment came up that sounded ideal for her at Lincoln Plaza, I was convinced the proximity to the opera would be the bonus element that would make her fall in love. She was reluctant, but when I showed her the apartment and guided her over to the window, I saw her eyes light up. There was a view of Lincoln Center's famous fountain. She could practically hear the music from the opera house right in her living room. This was the moment when everything clicked together. Of course, she bought it. Ultimately, in every sale, there's always the same emotional cycle, which ranges from excitement and disappointment to happiness and relief. To manage a lot of balls, you must be ready to handle every part of the cycle and know which stage each ball is in. It's like a brewing storm that you must be prepared for. Tornadoes don't just pop out of nowhere. There are usually warning signs. Rain, high winds, flying cows. This is true whether someone is buying a wedding dress or a pair of skis. Good salespeople learn to anticipate what direction a deal will go, and they understand how each stage of the sale will help them get deals done faster. The goal is to emerge from the messiest of sales, even as ruinous as an F5, aka the Hand of God tornado, unscathed. The stages of every sale. As a real estate broker, I've seen it all. Nothing surprises me anymore, ever. Except that one time when a client gave me an adorable baby pig as a gift. I did not see that coming. But every sale I make runs through the same 7 stages. There is nothing new. Shopping, whether it's for a home or for a pair of shoes, is more about mastering the 7 stages of selling than a need. Footnote. I resort to shoe buying examples frequently, as I am a very experienced shoe shopper. End footnote. Sure, we all need shoes and a place to live. Humans require shelter. And I don't know about where you live, but the streets in New York City are disgusting, and I'd rather die than touch them with my bare feet. But if shopping for a home or a pair of shoes or a massage, or anything at all, really, were only about need, it would never take more than a couple of minutes to purchase anything. The thing is, no one ever walks into a shoe store barefoot. Chances are, most people own at least one pair of shoes, and technically, you only need one pair to protect your feet from freezing cold temperatures and sharp, rusty nails. People walk into a shoe store because buying more shoes fulfills a want. The entire process of buying a product, any product, is the same with every transaction. Some transactions are just quicker than others. Some jump around the chart a little. But 95% of the time, every deal follows the same stages of selling I'm going to outline for you now. If you learn to anticipate what customers will likely do during each stage of the sale, you'll be in a great position to use the appropriate tool to anticipate your next move and keep the sale moving toward a close. Stage 1. Excitement. Remember Campbell Killian from the Master of Follow-Up chapter? I sold his combined penthouse with the weird layout after I had a party in it for babies. Well, later, I had the good fortune to help him buy his dream home, and he had a budget of $20 million. Campbell was smitten when he saw the apartment. This was it. It was in a beautiful building on Park Avenue with 15-foot ceilings. He could imagine making pancakes for his kids in the gourmet kitchen or watching the sunset over the city on his gigantic terrace while drinking phenomenally expensive scotch. Campbell was pumped. Then he heard the price. The asking price was $40 million. This apartment was my wow stop. I told him there was a similar apartment on a lower floor with lower ceilings for less. But Campbell had seen the light, and there was no going back, even if he was spending more than he planned. We offered $30 million, but settled at $36 million. Back to being pumped! In the excitement stage, a buyer is focusing on all of the positives of the product and how it will change their lives for the better. They're falling in love. Signs you're in the excitement stage include comments such as, "I love this." "Oh my God, I'm so happy I'm getting this. This is the greatest day of my life." Fist pumps, tears of joy. Stage 2, frustration. Enter complications. The contract was difficult to negotiate. The seller was really tough and fought back on every concession Campbell wanted. Did I mention the building wasn't even built yet? It adds to the frustration when the product, apartment, car, custom-made sofa, doesn't actually exist yet. Campbell was starting to feel this apartment wasn't worth all the trouble. Uh-oh, the tornado alarm has sounded. In the frustration stage, the buyers focused on the negatives. They're suddenly seeing everything that is wrong with the product. They haven't pulled out of the deal, but they're annoyed. This phase could also be called the blame phase, since most buyers start to blame other people, most often that's us, for their frustration. Signs you're in the frustration stage include impatient phone calls and texts, emails asking why things are taking so long, threats to back out of the deal. Stage 3, fear. Campbell's frustration blossomed into full-fledged fear when the seller refused to contractually agree to what the decibel level would be in the apartment that was not yet built. He worried he was overpaying. If the seller was being difficult about decibel levels, he must be hiding something. He feared the super high ceilings weren't high enough. Ultimately, he questioned whether he was making a bad investment. Campbell convinced himself there was an equally amazing apartment just waiting to be found, so he killed the deal. Though it had been love at first sight, he decided to walk away from his dream apartment with its cozy pancake breakfast and stunning sunsets. We started the process over and started looking at more apartments. Fear had touched down like a tornado and was destroying everything in its wake. An interesting development. In this case, fear actually revived the deal. It soon became clear that Campbell just couldn't love any other apartments the way he loved the Park Avenue apartment. His fear morphed from, I can't commit to this, to, Ryan, what have I done? I've made a horrible mistake. Can you please help me win her back? You know how what goes up must come down? In sales, it's the opposite. What is down? Prices, deals, a client's emotional state must go back up. Only once a client has entered the fear stage are they emotionally ready to climb back up the ladder of positivity and make a deal. Out of all that fear comes a positive result. In the fear stage, the buyer starts to feel afraid of what he's taken on. Can I handle this? Did I spend too much? Do I really need this? They are actively questioning their decision to make the purchase. Signs you're in the fear stage include angry, incessant phone calls and texts, emails in the middle of the night featuring multiple exclamation points, swearing, yelling, more tears, but now the sad and angry kind. Stage 4. Disappointment. Good news, the apartment was still available. The seller was still open to doing the deal and even agreed to some vague language regarding the sound levels in the apartment. They made it official. They signed the contract. But before a bottle of champagne could be uncorked, disappointment reared its very ugly and incredibly annoying head. The minute the paperwork was signed, Campbell worried again that he had spent too much. How did he go $16 million over his budget? He told his bank not to send the wire for the down payment. He was disappointed and had to think. Ugh! Stage 4 is the worst! In the disappointment stage, the magnitude of the purchase starts to weigh on the buyer. They start to seem overwhelmed, anxious, and distant. Signs you're in the disappointment stage include the client feeling regret and remorse, forgetting that this apartment, car, wedding gown, etc. was the one that made them feel all tingly inside, and ignoring your texts and emails. Stage 5. Acceptance. Campbell came to terms with what he knew from the beginning. This was his apartment, and no other could match it. He made the deposit, and he needed to move forward. His wife thought the apartment was light years beyond even her wildest dreams, and this made him happy. Back to visions of pancakes and cocktails. I also reminded him of how hard we fought for the best deal. He was now both calm and pumped. Stage 5 is a pretty good place to be. In the acceptance stage, the positives start to flow back. The buyer starts to remember the journey they've gone through to procure this amazing item. The fear melts away and the joy slides back. Signs you're in the acceptance phase include happy spouses and children in for pop-up office visits, thank you notes or gifts, peace, quiet, and calm. Stage 6. Happiness. The more Campbell thought about his totally insane new apartment, the more excited he got about the idea of moving in. The next chapter of his life will begin in his dream home. He's like a little kid awaiting his birthday, crossing off days on the calendar. He can't wait for the big moment. In the happiness stage, the customer is bursting with excitement. The joy is on par with the last day of school, Christmas morning, or the day your mom says, "Fine, you can get a puppy." Signs you're in the acceptance phase include constant emails about when the product will arrive. They connect you to their friends who they think should buy from you. And the happiness phase is the best time to ask for referrals. Stage 7. Relief. Shortly after Campbell closed on his apartment, someone bought the one directly above his for $45 million. $9 million more than he paid. Markets come and markets go, but Campbell felt relieved that he bought his dream home when he did. The time was right. In the relief stage, the customer is now comfortable with the purchase. Any obstacles faced, all the highs and lows, no longer matter. The purchase was also their idea the whole time. Ha ha! Imagine that. Signs you're in the relief stage include bragging, boasting. It's such a good thing I bought that when I did. I can't believe that guy paid even more than me. What a sucker. The Serhant Toolkit of Emotions. We all know that sales are usually bumpy. I will always do everything in my power to close a deal. But there are times when there is nothing I can do to save it. It's DOA, dead on arrival. I have to let it go. Most sales are messy, but I've created a toolbox to help. It's full of different techniques I use to smooth over difficult situations and gently guide clients through the stages of the sale. There's no one single solution for each problem a salesperson will face because every sale is different. But I've learned that these tools can be effective in many different situations. When a client is being difficult or is MIA, maybe they're in the frustration stage. 9 out of 10 times, if a client is bursting with excitement about a purchase, be ready to tackle the fear phase because it's right around the corner and will be arriving soon. If you find yourself in a situation where you need to guide your client to a different place, use these tools. We've all been there. When I'm working on a particularly tough deal, where the sale is full of drama, so gut-wrenching my client deserves to be nominated for a Tony, I remind myself to be empathetic. I'm a salesperson, but that doesn't mean I'm immune to the stages of the sale. None of us are. It can help to remember that we've all been there. We've all wanted to buy something and have ended up riding a roller coaster of emotions. When I started selling more apartments, I decided I deserved a nice watch. Every successful person who bought an apartment from me wore a great watch. My boss went with me to the watch store on Madison Avenue, where I proceeded to go through every stage of the sale, just like my clients. Finally, I saw it. A nice, shiny Breitling. Oh, hello, beautiful watch. Then I saw the price. I was like, what is wrong with you, boss? Why would you bring me here? These prices are crazy. But I love it. Only to be followed by, wait, this city is probably full of beautiful watches. I must see them all. But I love this one. Finally, I bought it, then promptly felt sick that I had spent all that money. Surely, I could have gotten a better deal. But then I put it on, and it looked fantastic. Thank God I bought it. I could be walking around town wearing a swatch. Who would hire that guy to sell his apartment? I went through every single stage of the sale in a span of 30 minutes. Buying something is an emotional experience. So remember this when you're in the messy middle of a tough sale. Put yourself in your client's shoes. Talk to them. Listen to them. Try saying, we've all been there. I sympathize with what you're going through. I understand how hard these decisions can be. This is the hard part. It's gonna get easier. We are in this together. I love selling brownstones, but these deals can be delicate. If I'm not extra attentive, these deals can die a quick and violent death via an inspector or an attorney. It is an inspector's job to find problems, and there is just no such thing as a problem-free brownstone. Most of them are really old. If I know an inspection is about to take place, I'll talk to the buyer about what they should expect. I assure them that when the inspector comes back with a gloom and doom story about a 7-year-old furnace, there's no reason to panic. And if I didn't do this, they would kill the deal the second they heard the words like lead paint. I assure clients that we can address these issues in the contract, and that there's no need to flee the city for a nice split-level ranch somewhere in the Midwest. To keep things running smoothly throughout every stage of the sale, I'm as upfront as possible, and I set expectations. I'm preparing the customer for possible outcomes and assuring them that we will tackle these challenges together. It's almost like a doctor-patient relationship. Sure, your doctor is probably a genius, but that's not what makes you feel good about her ability to help you if you break all your toes in a freak bowling accident. It's her knowledge. You're confident she'll fix your toes. She's assured you she's up to the task, and you're in it together until you hobble out of the hospital on crutches. When times get tough in any kind of sale, you need to have a doctor-patient level relationship. Your clients need to know they can turn to you for help, and you'll be with them until the problem is solved. Try saying, "We are in this together. I'll be with you until this is finished. I'm here for you throughout this entire process. If there's a problem, we'll figure it out together, one step at a time." The indecisive client. Push, pull, and persist. Some people would rather exist in a dark, murky state of limbo than make a decision. Decision-making is often hard and uncomfortable. It's much easier to just sit on your couch binge-watching Black Mirror than it is to take action. If you're in sales, inaction is enemy number one. There is nothing more worrisome to a salesperson than indecision. It can stall or even kill a deal. To combat this mortal enemy, I use a combination of push, pull, and persistence to guide clients to the next stage of the sale. The push. Barking orders at clients is a good way to freak them out and get them to either buy from someone else or simply avoid you. While we can't dictate what a client should do, we can push. We can ease them off their ultra-comfy sofa of indecision. The push is gentle but firm, and it can be just the thing that gets the client unstuck and ready to make a purchase. Ways to use the push include offer incentives. While I certainly don't want to be viewed as Ryan Serhant's discount broker, I have made deliberate decisions to lower my commission to get a listing I wanted or to get a deal done. Think about what else you can offer a client to get them to take action today. Is the awesome suit they're hesitating to buy going on sale tomorrow? Tell them about the sale and that you'll speak with your manager about getting them the sale price today. Sometimes, adding a small incentive is just the thing that will tip a customer to yes. Offer 2-for-1. Offer free shipping. Small incentives create more sales, and I'd much rather make $10 than no dollars. Create urgency. We all know that people tend to want things they can't have. Is the handbag they're looking at the last one in stock? Create urgency by sharing that nugget of information. Obviously, you need to know what kind of urgency you can reasonably create. If a guy is trying on a sweater that he's picked up out of a pile of 100, he clearly knows it's not the last one. Create urgency a different way. Maybe say, "Are you going out tonight? That looks great on you. You should wear it." The pull. The pull is what it sounds like. Pulling an item away from a client to prompt them to move forward. It can be very effective if done right. To execute the pull, you must use grace. It's not like ripping off a band-aid. I often use the pull when selling very, very expensive apartments. There are moments when a client is hesitating and I have to say, "This is really expensive. It might be too expensive for you. Let's look at less expensive options." This move results in an instant gut check. It's like hitting the reset button on a frozen iPhone. The gut check causes the client to realize that yes, this is what they want, and yes, they can afford it. The pull isn't just for expensive items. It's also a great tool to use when you know a product is wrong for a customer. That's when you, the salesperson, get to come in and save the day. "Oh, you're interested in buying a chinchilla for your kid's birthday? Have you considered a guinea pig? They are considered the best first pet for children because they are so friendly and easy to care for." When that parent realizes she made the better choice and it's all because you pulled her away from the chinchilla, she'll come back to you when her other child wants a pet rattlesnake. Persist. In some cases, neither the push nor the pull is quite right. In these instances, a salesperson needs to persist. You're not actively pushing, and you're not pulling back, but you are reminding them that the product they're considering is perfect for them. Recently, I had a client who was $100,000 away from closing a deal for an apartment on the Upper West Side. He refused to move up if the seller wouldn't come down. I knew that the apartment was actually priced right. To have come down from the asking price would have been underselling it, and I knew that. I persisted with my client. Every 2 days, I sent him a message about the deal. One message would be about how I'm trying to hold it for him. Another message would be about a new comp sale that justified the asking price. A third message would be my suggesting he see it again. He agreed to take another look. We talked about his issues, and it was clear he was in the fear stage. I used my tools to get what was down back up, and he bought.